You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
I've been getting in my steps, lifting weights, and now I'm trying really hard to get as much protein as I can. That's why I'm excited about trying Clean Simple Eats, because they're just that, clean and simple. Their protein powder is always grass-fed with no seed oils or artificial ingredients. It's third-party tested and non-GMO and gluten-free. They've got 26 delicious all-natural flavors. You really can't go wrong with any of them. They've got Simply Vanilla and other unique flavors like cookies and cream, caramel toffee, and even cinnamon roll. I have a feeling my entire family may just like Clean Simple Eats protein powder, and they're probably going to use it every day because it's so easy to put into your milk or a recipe my daughter loves to bake, or in a smoothie, which my son loves to drink almost every day. It's amazing, really, in any form. Visit cleansimpleeats.com and use the code ASKLISA20 at checkout for 20% off your first order. That's cleansimpleeats.com with the code ASKLISA20 for 20% off your first order. Hi, I'm Rena Ninen, and this is Ask Lisa, the Psychology of Parenting podcast. It's a podcast to help parents better understand their kids. Dr. Lisa Demore, a psychologist with 3 decades of experience and the author of 3 New York Times best-selling parenting books, takes your questions. Both of us are moms ourselves, and we're eager to hear from you. So send us your questions to AskLisa at drlisademore.com. And you can join our community by following us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The handle is AskLisaPodcast. And also subscribe to our brand new YouTube channel, Ask Lisa Podcast. Episode 158, Practical Optimism with Dr. Sue Varma. I just find it difficult in the dead of winter. February is a hard month, Lisa. It's so hard. Why?
Rena, try doing February in Cleveland.
You
it's
always
really
win.
Not that fun.
You always win.
It's really not that fun. We have our moments, but it is really it's where true believers really, you know, Cleveland has its really strong loyalty, and this is how it shows.
I love that. Well, I find it's February is sort of the time of the school year where I feel like stuck in the mud or the snow. It's kind of hard to keep trudging forward sometimes. And how do you stay true and find optimism? Right? I just think it's hard.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a hard time. And it's interesting, Rena, clinically, I can tell you my caseload and my colleagues' caseloads, they always build in February, that whatever else is going on, things start to really, people really are feeling the weight of the year.
Or so
the
it's
weight
not
of
just
the winter
a feeling.
On top of everything else. It's not just a feeling. It's
you
something
have
I've
data
consistently
to,
seen.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, this is exactly why I couldn't be more excited to have this next guest who has a book, an incredible book called Practical Optimism, the Art and Science and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being. Dr. Sue Varma is going to join us. She's a psychiatrist and a cognitive behavioral therapist based in New York City. She's got over 2 decades of private practice experience. And today, her book is officially out. You've seen probably some of her advice in the New York Times over the past few weeks. She believes that physicians have a duty to not only take their patients from a state of dysfunction to function, but also from functional to optimal. I love that. Dr. Sue Varma, welcome.
Thank you so much, Rena. Thank you, Lisa. It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you. I'm so excited to talk to you both today.
We are so glad to have you here. And I will say, I got to read a copy of this book early because I had the honor of blurbing it. And Rena and Sue, I don't blurb everything that comes my way. I pick and choose. And I was so excited as I got into this book to just see how gorgeously Sue took what we know on the clinical side and the academic side and translated it for immediate practical use in the hands of, you know, we have a lot of parents who listen. I think their older kids could get a huge benefit out of it, but we also know you know, kids do as well as their parents are doing. So this was an incredible gift to families and adults. And Sue, I'm just so grateful to you for writing it.
Thank you so much, Lisa. And I'm so grateful to you for you reading it, you blurbing it. I'm a huge admirer of everything that you do. And every day I feel like lucky to get a little snippet of some wisdom from you, you know, and I look forward to it on social media. I share it with parent friends, with patients. So thank you for saying that. And, you know, really that's what we need right now is very concrete, actionable, tangible steps that also really recognize and honor what people have been through. You know, it's not enough. And that's what I say, how this sort of differentiates optimism from toxic positivity is that we don't want to say, hey, just look on the bright side without really acknowledging what the suffering that people are experiencing for a variety of reasons, and then also giving them a path forward. And so that's the practical side of the optimism.
I love it. And Sue, actually, that gets to something I want to have us start with, which is your backstory. So you were a trainee in a New York hospital on September 11th.
Yes.
So here you are. And I remember what it was like, right, to be a you know, green clinician, you know, learning as you go. And suddenly you are dealing with caring for people going through incredible stress and trauma and helping them move towards resilience and growth. What did that moment in your career teach you? Like, what did you learn through that experience?
Yes. I mean, I saw how unbelievably resilient people are by nature. And I feel like in many ways, it can almost be our default setting, and then life gets in the way. You know, like none of us are going to get to leave this world without grief and loss and disappointment. Some of it will be the big T, you know, the life-threatening trauma that many people experience that day. And some of it will be the little T's, you know, the breakups, the divorce, the job loss. And what I learned was, when I met these patients later on, I was a trainee at that point, I got tons of education, sought it out, and eventually became the medical director of this 9/11 mental health program. And what was so amazing was that the program was integrated into the fold of the medical and the primary care. And what I love about that, and that really is an ideal model, is that people then take their mental health seriously on par with all the medical symptoms. So people would come in for screenings, they would come in for a battery of tests for asthma, for GI problems. And as we know, people had many medical problems, cancers related to 9/11. We saw rescue, recovery, first responders, people who were residents working down there. And many of these people witnessed loved ones, family members die or get seriously injured or were themselves seriously injured. And I began to get very interested in the idea of resilience. And one of the features of resilience was optimism. Now, no one talks about optimism. It's considered mm-hmm. this, how, you know, feel good. What is this Pollyanna positive thinking nonsense? There's no science behind it. And then I spent the last 20 years looking for the science and really recognizing that while 25% of optimism is genetic, you know, I always thought, you know, you're either born with it, this sort of glass half full thinking. I realize actually 75% of it is within our hands. And what is so interesting is that these are all skills that each one of us can learn, coping skills, emotional regulation skills, reaching out for support. And then I realized that, wow, how amazing would it be that we don't break, that we bend when something bad happens to us.
I want to ask you about that, Sue. Why do you think it is that in the midst of horrific tragedy, some people manage to survive and then later thrive? What's the difference between what makes somebody completely broken and unable to get up and somebody able to find their way?
Yes. You know, what's so interesting is one thing that I learned is, you know, one of these experiments that I was fascinated by, and I was very much inspired by the work of Dr. Martin Seligman, you know, founder and father of positive psychiatry, one of them at least, and this study of learned helplessness. And what I found so fascinating, what we had always thought, so just to give you a little background about the study, is that, you know, the study had been done with dogs. We're not, you know, promoting animal testing and, you know, cruelty to them. But what we learned from this experiment decades ago, initially was that when you treat dogs, and then it was later applied to humans, you know, you keep shocking them, you keep exposing them to adversity. At first you give them a way out, but then when you don't, they learn their helplessness. And years later, these researchers came to find out that it's not that you learn helplessness. What these dogs, when they were allowed to be free, some of them didn't escape. They were like, why bother? They got depressed. They're like, I don't need to leave. Like, even though the doors were open, they were shocked. Then the doors were open and they never left, compared to people who realized, or dogs that realized that they could leave. And the difference is that you don't learn your helplessness, you learn your agency. And they actually came back 40 years later and revised it. So our default mode is to sometimes give up. But if anybody in our life gives us just a little bit of support and say, hey, the door is open, you can leave now, the shock is over, if we can see a little glimmer of hope at the end, we're more likely to take it and say, you know what, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. So, you know, I think some of it is genetic, that we're hardwired. Some of it is early childhood experiences of being, exposed to abuse or trauma or loss, or neglect, or not having parenting or secure attachments. But a lot of it is learned over time. And I think if we can see any mastery, any sort of skill building, like, hey, I did this, and we can carry it forward. I think mastery in one area lends itself to mastery in another. And I know that there been so many times when I've taken on challenges and I'm like, I can't do this. And I've had to be reminded by people that love me. And they're like, no, you are doing it. You can do it. What did you do in this other aspect? See, it worked out for you there. So even I very much have to practice this. And that's why I call it, there's a practical aspect, but then there's a practice aspect. We have to practice optimism.
I love that, Sue. And it's funny, I think about, you know, our clinical training. And one of the things I remember learning along the way is that what therapy does is it gives people options, right? It doesn't tell them what to do. It gives people options. And that's what you're saying. Like, there's an open door. You can go through that open door. Okay. So thinking about your work and what you've brought across in this wonderful book, if there are listeners thinking, okay, well, let's put it on the ground. Like, what are some things I could do to feel a little bit better? You know, what would you say? You have these wonderful pillars of practical optimism in the book. Like, walk us through a couple of these.
Yes. So, you know, the first one, and, you know, they're in no particular order, but I like it because the first one is purpose, and purpose could be your purpose in life, or it could be what your purpose is in an interaction with someone. So let's say you're having difficulty do I want to confront them or not, and say, what is my intention? And just the fact that you stop and pause to say, what is my intention? What is my desired outcome? Is it to get closer to this person? If that's the case, I'm probably not going to yell and reprimand them. I might seek to understand. So just having pause is very helpful. The other part of purpose is sometimes in life, if we feel as if we don't have a purpose, because we're seeing that a lot of people are experiencing burnout right now. A lot of people are experiencing languishing, where you're not fully depressed, but you're just not feeling great. Sometimes recognizing that if you can't find a purpose, it's on you to create it. And this idea from cognitive behavioral therapy of behavioral activation, of putting the cart before the horse, not waiting for motivation, not waiting for someone, you know, I would joke with my patients who are like, I'm single and I really want to meet somebody. And I'm like, they're not going to fall from the ceiling into your lap in this office, right? It's what we do in between sessions where you're out in the world and creating those opportunities for yourself. And so sometimes we don't feel motivated, but that's okay. You know, and I think that, you know, action begets more action. So if you're able to start a little bit of something, and then in that chapter, I talk about role remake at your job or job crafting, this idea of if you're in a job where you're like, I'm not experiencing meaning, I feel like I'm making the company money, what am I doing for myself? What am I doing for my family? Your purpose does not have to come from your job. It's great if it's connected to your paycheck, but it doesn't have to. And you can ask your boss, are there little things that I can do that are more aligned with my interests, my hobbies? And it might be something like doing, you know, a charity race with coworkers, if you want. So that's just one pillar. And I talk about different ways that a person can achieve purpose, even giving back. We know that adults who volunteer live longer. We know that children who volunteer, teenagers, or who help younger kids with their homework, have less inflammation, less likely to have cardiac disease later in life. So there's so much science behind altruism and giving back. And if you don't feel like you have a purpose, so much of depression turns us inward. It forces us to ruminate. When we're out in the world engaged with other people, engaged in hobbies, engaged in awe, this idea of experiencing something bigger than yourself, it could be going to a museum, it could be going to a beautiful national park, it takes you out of your mind and it short circuits this whole rumination cycle. So that's just one pillar, and there's so many, and I'm happy to get into them.
Yeah. So we're going to pause and take a quick break. And then on the other side of this, I want to ask you a little bit about visualization. Is that real? Does that help with optimism? And then also, we're going to talk a little bit about negative self-talk and victimhood and what that does as well. We'll be right back. You're listening to Ask Lisa, the Psychology of Parenting.
I'm all for healthy habits, but I don't trust quick fixes. This is why I love Daily Harvest. They take all of the work out of eating well, and all I have to do is enjoy. Daily Harvest makes it so easy for me to eat in the nutritious and delicious ways that I like. They take the planning, the prep, the cleanup out of cooking, and they deliver meals that are packed with vegetables and fruits straight to my door. The other thing I love about them is that it's not the same old boring meals. I love their dragon fruit and lime smoothie. I also love their butternut squash and rosemary soup. They also have this wonderful herb squash and asparagus risotto. Create healthy habits that last with Daily Harvest. For a limited time only, go to dailyharvest.com/asklisa to get $30 off your first box plus free shipping. That's dailyharvest.com/asklisa for $30 off your first box and free shipping. dailyharvest.com/asklisa.
So I'm really starting to feel it in my mid-40s, just how much stress, hormone fluctuation, and the lack of sleep can really affect the way your skin looks, from dry skin to dark spots and acne. This is why I love OneSkin. They can really help. They've got a simple skincare routine that tackles skin issues at the cellular level. I love that this is an all-women team of scientists. OneSkin's developed a proprietary peptide called OS1 that's scientifically validated to actually improve the health of your skin beneath the surface. No irritation, no complicated multi-step routine. It's so simple. I really have felt the difference in how my face looks after using this product. OneSkin is the world's first skin longevity company by focusing on the cellular aspect of aging. OneSkin keeps your skin looking and acting younger for longer. So get started today. Try it out with 15% off using the code ASKLISA at oneskin.co. That's 15% off oneskin.co with the code ASKLISA. And after your purchase, they'll ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them the Ask Lisa podcast sent you.
Earth Breeze Eco Sheets look just like a dryer sheet, but instead of being a dryer sheet, they're in fact an ultra-concentrated liquidless laundry detergent. It's really the best of all worlds. Earth Breeze is tough on stains and odors while being kind to the planet and to your skin. Personally, I get a huge kick out of using Earth Breeze. I love the fact that it takes up less space, is better for the environment, and yet it leaves my clothes smelling so good and it gets them so clean. Here's the bottom line. Making a positive impact in the world doesn't have to come at a cost to you. My clothes are clean, they smell great, and I feel like I actually did something good, not just for my laundry, but also for the earth. Right now, my listeners can receive 40% off Earth Breeze just by going to earthbreeze.com/asklisa. That's earthbreeze.com/asklisa to cut out single-use plastic in your laundry room and claim 40% off your subscription. earthbreeze.com/asklisa.
Welcome back to Ask Lisa, the Psychology of Parenting. We've got special guest Dr. Sue Varma joining us on this episode with her brand new book. We're excited about this for Sue, talking about practical optimism, the art, science, and practice of exceptional well-being. Sue, I gotta ask you, when you talk about victimhood, that, you know, the narrative that sometimes goes in your head, why do some people, when bad things happen, continue to tell themselves that they're a victim? And how does that mindset negatively affect their life?
Yes. So, you know, again, some people might be hardwired to experience pessimism. And what was interesting about what I learned is that pessimism and optimism are not two ends of the same spectrum. They're actually separate entities. And I'm glad you asked about this because victimhood is pessimism. It's assuming that things that happen in the world are meant personally to harm you, that you have no agency, that you have no control, and it keeps you trapped. You think that this negative thing will last forever. You think that it is an indication of who you are as a person, as a total failure, not just in one circumscribed aspect. And it paralyzes you. So while it may be your default setting, it doesn't mean that you can't simultaneously ask yourself to reframe the situation and say, okay, this happened to me. Okay, I can continue to find myself a victim. But what's the utility? And when I was working with 9/11 patients, you know, that question is something that I learned in my work with them, because they would say, Dr. Varma, I know what you're saying, but a terrorist attack could happen tomorrow. So why would I go back on the subway? Why would I go back to downtown Manhattan? And I was dumbfounded because, like, you got me stumped. You're right. These things do happen and they can happen. You know, there was a huge crane incident in New York City. I mean, things fall from the sky, and, you know, but what's the utility? Is that if we allowed ourselves to believe that would happen every single day, then none of us would ever leave our house again. So in no way am I ever trying to diminish what a person has been through, the trauma that they have suffered. And I want to acknowledge that it was horrific what happened that day. And you could literally fill in the blank with whatever your personal loss, tragedy is. And at the same time, can you find it within yourself to push through? And so to me, the resilience is the ability to bounce back from adversity. But optimism is about the ability to flourish in the face of it. And it says, I know that these things can happen. One of my favorite quotes in the book is that I share is that even if I knew the world would end tomorrow, I would still plant my apple tree. And there's some controversy about who said it, Martin Luther King, Martin Luther. But I just loved it. And I said, you know, we don't know who to attribute it to. But even still, these things will happen. So victimhood, yes, you can sit in it. But what happens is then it festers within you in the form of either shame or guilt. Mm. But what it does is diminish your personal agency. And that's what this book is all about, is acknowledgement, having compassion towards yourself, something that I struggled with. And I talk about that in one of the chapters. But then what is a way forward and out of it?
Well, actually, just to pick up on that, on the compassion piece. So earlier this season, we had Dr. Tracy Baxley come on and talk with us about compassion. And one of the things that comes up in your book is struggling with personal compassion and using negative self-talk, running oneself down. So when it comes to negative self-talk, which, you know, I think many of us can be prone to at times, like, how do we flip the script on this? How do we move into a place of being gentler with ourselves and more accepting?
Yes. You know, when we talk about self-compassion, I'm also very much an admirer of the work of Dr. Kristen Neff. And she talks about the ideas of three common threads. One is a mindful observation of what you're experiencing. So I always say to my patients, notice these negative thoughts the way you would notice airport baggage carousel. You see it go by. You may have comments and judgment about it, but you don't go home with somebody else's baggage.
Love that. Okay, I am stealing that. That is the best description ever I have heard of letting things go by. That is apt and funny at the same time. Okay, keep going. Keep going.
Thank you. So don't invest in these negative thoughts. Be aware of them and let them go. The second part is the acceptance of it, of, okay, I have this. Okay, this happened to me. Or, okay, I messed up. I did this. I screwed up. Okay. And then the common humanity piece, which I love so much because it says, am I the only person who has ever screwed up in the world? I am not alone in this. We all do this. This is what bonds us. I'm not the first person. And I think for me, what's really helpful is hearing about other people's difficulties. And they're like, you know, Sue, I struggled with the same thing. Do you know I went through this? Why do you beat yourself up over this? And all of these three things then gives you a path forward. After you accept, after you observe and mindfully notice, and after you recognize that you're not alone, it then allows you to move forward. And what I love and I talk about in the book is the beauty and the science behind the self-compassion, that when students take tests, they took a math test, they failed it. When they did self-compassion exercises and asked themselves these three questions, are you alone in this? Can you observe it? Can you accept it? They actually came back and beat the kids that didn't and scored higher than those who failed but then did not do the self-compassion exercises. Mm. When parents who are struggling with children and are beating themselves up because they feel helpless and hopeless do self-compassion exercises, they are more effective with their children. So this is not just one of those woo-woo concepts. There is real science behind it. And everything in this book, whether it's optimism or self-compassion, I talk about the studies. And all of these benefits, you see them in the form of accelerated wound healing after surgeries, less recurrence of cancer, less anxiety, less depression. So in the prevention, in the maintenance phase of recovery, and then also in just optimization of wellness. And I always say that, you know, while all of us, you know, there might be one out of five people, that's the statistic, will experience mental illness in their life. But five out of five of us can experience mental wellness. So even if you're struggling with depression and anxiety does not mean that you can't also engage in activities that bring you joy and that bring you happiness while you're also in treatment. So, you know, this book is never meant to replace the good work that you're doing individualized with a therapist, but it can certainly be a supplement and an adjunct and give you a way forward to give you hope. And that's what I want people to take away, is like, there's hope. Like, doesn't matter what you've been through, you're not alone. And you have a tool kit mm-hmm. for life, a friend for life. Think of Practical Optimism as a friend.
I also love it. In your book, you've got these exercises. So, you know, go get the book, because they tell you, she walks us through exactly what to do. If you're wondering what that self-compassion exercise is, it's in the book. Sue, I want to ask you on the topic of a woo-woo that I really believe in. You know, Lisa's always grounded in the science. That's what you're coming to this podcast. We are grounded in science. So I am obsessed with visualization and manifestation. My husband makes fun of me all the time on this. But you talk a little bit about this from a medical and science perspective. I'm curious, does it really work? And am I crazy for feeling this way? What does the science say about visualization?
Yes, Rena, you're not crazy at all. The science shows that when we envision the best possible outcome, we are more likely to achieve it. So manifest away, visualize away. And the only thing I would say is just back it up with action steps. That's all I would say, is that when you are visualizing the best possible outcome, also take the time to plot out the steps to achieve it.
And why do you think it works when I'm visualizing it? How do I get to that goal by visualizing it?
Yes. When you visualize it, what you're doing is you're recognizing A, the steps that you need to take, and B, the obstacles that are in your way that you need to account for. And then C, it helps you realize, like, oh, this is who I can ask. This is who I can help. So for example, let's say you want an exercise routine, you're gonna need help from your husband to take care of kids. You're able to visualize, all right, from point A to point B, these are the steps that I'm going to need to take. And I can see that these are where the obstacles might come in. And then this is who I'm going to ask to help to eliminate those obstacles. And it also puts you in a positive mood, so that when you finish visualizing, you're like, I'm pumped, I'm ready, let's go. And so you need that extra motivation. There's a little bit of a dopamine kick of like, let's go, let's do this. And we need the dopamine kick, because then we're not going to, without it, we're not motivated. And I want people to do this. Take 5 minutes and sit. Envision a problem. Envision how your body feels. Allow your body to feel the negativity. Is it clenched jaw? Is it tight fists? What is it that you're feeling? And then I also want you to imagine a path stretching out before you. You know, and you can do this sitting down with your shoulders, you know, relaxed, eyes closed. And then I want you to imagine a path forward. That path leads to the best possible outcome. Take your time going down that path. Ask yourself to visualize that path. What does it look like? Is it straight? Is it windy? And then imagine yourself arriving at that best possible outcome. And I want you to feel all the feelings that come with that, the joy, the relief. And hold on to that feeling and come back to it every day. The next thing is, think about the steps that you're going to take to lead to it, right? So we never want someone to say, I'm manifesting this, but then not do the hard work that's behind it.
Oh, man. So I just... The people who work with you clinically are so lucky, and now everybody's so lucky. I mean, I think that that's what's so beautiful about books, right, is that you can just scale this kind of wisdom. Okay, let's take a minute on relationships here. We've been talking a lot about, you know, between ourselves and ourselves. Let's talk about ourselves and other people. You know, obviously, this has been an incredibly hard time. People have been isolated a tremendous amount. Relationships are tricky. You know, what I'm hearing in schools is that kids are having a much harder time with one another in terms of how they are treating each other at school. In your book, you talk about attachment and attachment style being so critical in terms of how people size up and are able to engage in relationships. Talk to us a little bit about, for our listeners, from the parenting side of this, what do they want to be thinking about as they lay down these patterns at home with their own children?
Yes, I love that. And Lisa, I would say you are the expert on that. But if I were to give it my 2 cents from a practical optimism point of view, I think one of the most interesting things that I learned is that how we come to a relationship, whether it be with our partner, whether we are a student approaching a new classroom in the beginning of a school year, or joining a new club or a new sport and we don't know anyone, when you approach anybody with the idea that this person may have my best intentions at heart. When we give people the benefit of the doubt, when we seek the best, we are more likely to get the best. Now, that doesn't always work. There's some people who are not going to like us. And even in our relationships, somebody may be very fixed in the way that they behave towards us. But we see that partners and couples where the perception of support is there. You may or may not get support from your partner, but just the mere fact that you perceive them to be supportive is correlated with your own well-being and the relationship's well-being. So I really believe that when we're dealing with our children, I feel like, you know, I have two kids and I'm, you know, very much learning, you know, and what I have learned, you know, as a parent that seems to be effective, and I'll come back to you and tell you how it is in a few years, but I think forgiveness, humility, and patience. And when I'm able to say, you know, if my kids call me out that like, you know, you said this or you said that, and I didn't like how you made me feel, I want to be quick to say, you know what, you're right, and I'm sorry, you know, and I'm sorry I hurt your feelings, and what can I do, and how can I be better? And that's not something I grew up with, you know, I don't remember growing up.
You're right. Same, Sue, I agree with you. Like, that, this was a game changer that Lisa taught me to do, and I can literally see every time I do it, the look on my kids, like, and I know that I'm building to them, for them, like, that they know that they need to do this too. If they screw up,
yes,
repair it quickly.
Yes.
And apologize.
Yes. And that, like, and then, and like taking the power dynamic out of it, like, I think of myself as a guide, you know, because like, there, yeah, I want to say if it was, trying to say if it was Cahil Gibran that said, like, your children don't come from you, they come through you, something like that, it might be. And looking at them and saying, okay, I'm a guide. And at some point when they're hitting their tween, you know, tween and teen years, is to say, like, you know, these are my thoughts, and to really respect their autonomy and their agency, and giving them the benefit of the doubt, and then saying that I don't always have all the answers, and leveling the playing field by sharing your own vulnerability. And I'm always cautious because I was like, I know this is going to come back to haunt me because you're going to throw it in my face. But you failed. But you failed. I know it's coming back. And I know, but you know, but we were having the sex talk, and Lisa, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this.
In the podcast,
but
of course.
It was really funny because, you know, my older son is at that age where now he's interested in girls. And he, you know, he told me, and we then, I was like, okay, that he was interested in somebody. And I was like, okay, well, we need to have the talk. And then he asked me about my sex life. And I was with me and my husband. And I was not prepared.
I would not have been prepared.
Yeah. But I answered it honestly. And he was so happy. He's like, good for you, Mom. And I was like, well, because I wanted to set an example of like what it is like to be in a committed, healthy, loving relationship. And part of me was a little bit thrown off because I was like, wait, you know, is this one of those, like, are you trying to gain some power over me? Because this is a very uncomfortable question for like a young boy to ask his mom. But then it opened it up where he was like, and then he started sharing about himself, about what he was planning on doing. And I was like, oh my God, I never would have gotten this information out of him had I not been vulnerable and took a chance and shared about myself. And then he was like, Mom, I'm good for you. I'm good for you. I'm happy for you and Dad that like you guys are so connected and spend time and feel this way about each other. And then like, that's what I want for myself when I grow up. And I was like, good, when you grow up, not right now.
Yes, very far down the line, this will be wonderful.
Yeah.
But, Sue, that's an incredible story.
I was not, you know, so I just feel like I'm thrown things every day, but it's like, I just like respecting them. And recognizing them as human being, and then and feeling that like I don't have them forever, you know, and like I'm lucky and blessed to have this time with you. But the best thing I can do is to equip you with skills so that when we're not together, you're always going to make the right choice. And maybe you're not going to, but it's okay because we haven't, you know, we have other chances.
Yeah. Sue, before you go, I want to ask you, how do we create daily good habits? Who are the people who master well being well? How are they able to make the pivot? And how do they stay there?
Yes. So to make certain things in your life non-negotiable, and I talk about in the book, the four M's of mental health, and you can really pick any habits that speak to you, but these are four that I picked that are science-backed, that when I had to give somebody advice, I was part of a pandemic program for Global Citizen, and it was, you know, all, with all these fancy people, Oprah and, you know, J-Lo and the late night hosts, and they said, you know, we want you to give people hope and give them action steps, what they can do to take care of their mental health and inspiration. And I was like, great, I have like an hour. They're like, no, you have 59 seconds. So I was like, all right, I'm going to pack it in. And in 59 seconds, I share four habits: mindfulness. So do whatever you can a couple of minutes a day to be in the moment. That could be just drinking a cup of coffee uninterrupted. It could be enjoying a sunset, being here present in whatever way. It could be doing a meditation, totally up to you, but doing something single-mindedly. The other is mastery, doing something that you do just for the fun of it, for nobody else but you. And you don't even have to be a master to experience mastery. You just have to want to get better at something. Movement. I talk about in the book how my dad, non-negotiable walks. He's 87, five miles a day. He picks up my kids from school. He walks. He's on the bike or the treadmill and does weights. And he will not start his day without doing this. Sometimes yoga, sometimes doing prayer. But this is a part of his habit. And I had a front row seat to the four M's and really practical optimism in many ways. So for him, it's non-negotiable. And I see that he has what we call exceptional longevity, which is not only living longer, but living longer in good health. Like this man, knock on wood, has zero medical problems. Wow. So while you could say genetics, I mean, he looks easily 10, 15 years younger. We travel all over the world together. He's the one initiating the travel, going hiking trips in Europe, seeing his friends from all over the world, and staying connected to people. So meaningful engagement in whatever form that means. And I think that it's
really— And is that the fourth M, meaningful engagement? Excellent.
Yeah. So taking time for him, it's, you know, reconnecting with friends from medical school, from different parts of the world, taking the time to meet them. He went to Vancouver Island to see one friend, went to Heidelberg to see another friend. So really keeping in contact with people and going deep, because I think that's what we're missing right now, Lisa and Mina. Like, I feel like a lot of people in relationships, friendships, young people especially, there's something called the shallowing hypothesis, that they're not going very deep in their friendships. Mm-hmm. We're not going very deep when we read. So when you do connect with someone, share a little bit something vulnerable. You know, I feel like I got a little vulnerable with you telling you about my son, and I'm so embarrassed about that story.
It's great.
But that's how we get close to one another, right? Yeah. Like sharing our challenges and asking for help, asking for advice. And you don't realize it that like when you put yourself out there, it's natural that other people are going to want to take care of you just a little bit. And that's how you form a bond. So don't be afraid to get close to people. And then in the book, I talk about all about habits, you know, about automating habits and how to eliminate choice and the steps in which you can take so that anything that you want to do should become automated, because you don't want to leave it to the mercy of being tired or whatever it might be.
Yeah. Yeah. I think about it in terms of, we've talked about it here, recovery routines, right? Mm. That they just have to be built in. Oh, Sue, thrilled for you that this book is out today. Thrilled for the world that this book is out today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you. So great to be here. And I learned so much from both of you. So thank you. This was an honor. Real pleasure.
The book is called Practical Optimism, The Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being with Dr. Sue Varma. So Lisa, what do you have for us for Parenting to Go?
So there's so much one could say, that it was an incredible conversation. I just want to bold and underline one thing that Sue said about how we enter relationships shaping what comes back to us. And when I've cared for young people who find themselves in sort of awkward social situations, which is pretty common, and who will start to ruminate about it and feel really nervous about seeing that person in class or seeing that person at sports, my guidance, and this is really how I say it, and it sounds really unsophisticated, but it really works as guidance. I'm like, here's what you want to do. Don't be weird. Just be totally normal, be friendly, be easygoing, assume they like you. You can drive the interaction into a more comfortable place by how you approach it. So I would say the takeaway today is that sometimes it is okay to say to kids, you're nervous about this interaction. My guidance, don't be weird.
That's great advice, Lisa, and a great finish of what was just an incredible podcast episode. I learned so much from both of you.
Yeah, she is really something special.
And next week, we're going to talk about what parents should do when their kids are introverts, and it can also make for very awkward feelings. I'll see you next week.
I'll see you next week.
Thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to the Ask Lisa podcast so you get the episodes just as soon as they drop. And send us your questions to AskLisa at drlisademore.com. And now a word from our lawyers. The advice provided on this podcast does not constitute or serve as a substitute for professional psychological treatment, therapy, or other types of professional advice or intervention. If you have concerns about your child's well-being, consult a physician or mental health professional. If you're looking for additional resources, check out Lisa's website at drlisademore.com. We'll see you next week.